This week we're talking about setting boundaries, and as I've mentioned to you a couple of times over the last several weeks, we've had a rather major trauma in our family where a lot of people have been very displeased with God for setting a boundary in taking our nephew Kevin home to heaven. This last weekend, we were in Chicago again for another family event, and got a chance to find out how God has been answering our prayers. That God, if we're going to have to deal with this horrible, horrible thing in the death of a 21-year-old young man, would you please bring glory to yourself through it? And it's been wonderful to find out how God has been answering that prayer. For one thing, we found his personal effects were shipped back from Iraq and from 29 Palms, where the Marine base is, and Kevin had some amazing things in his personal effects in terms of like his notebooks of that express his faith in the Lord that were tremendously encouraging. But I want to show you something that is physical evidence of how God brings glory to himself out of a tragedy. Last week there was a memorial service at his high school for the two graduates of Andrew High School in Tinley Park, Illinois, who have been killed in Iraq. And one, of course, was much more raw than the other, because the other one, he had graduated years before. He was an older guy. But in order to honor Kevin, who many of the kids knew because he didn't graduate that long ago, his nickname was Superman, because his last name was Clark, and you know he went by the nickname Clark Kent, and he was such an amazing young man that they called him Superman. Well, the students had hundreds and hundreds of these T-shirts made up that had the Superman logo on the front, and this is a public high school, okay? Got to imagine the sea of royal blue of students wearing this. This is on the front, printed on the back. I'm going to read it to you, was an excerpt from Kevin's testimony that he wrote as the final paper in a class on world religions that he was taking, and he turned in the paper the morning he was killed. This is what's on the back of this shirt. It is quite clear, if you seek, you will find, and if you ask, you will receive. God will supply the answers. All we have to do is ask the questions and have faith. This is being worn by hundreds of students in a public high school. Amazing. And, you know, this was the depth of his faith in God was incredible. And here are people being drawn to the Lord and to truth. A, if you ask, you will receive. And B, there is such a thing as truth, and God will give you answers. So It was very exciting for us to see how God is answering our prayers. God, bring glory to yourself through this horrible situation. So that was about one of the ways that God has been setting boundaries. I want to give you some suggestions today on a mindset and some very practical ideas on how to go about setting boundaries in your own life. Much of this is taken from a follow-up to the book Boundaries by Drs. Townsend and Cloud called Boundaries Face to Face. And it's about how to have the conversations that will result in setting boundaries. What do you need to say? A lot of it is scripting. So often, it would help us so much if somebody would just give us the words. This book is great for that. I want to open up with a story that they tell in the book from one of the authors. He says, "As a youth, I was a Boy Scout. Scouting was a big part of my life, and Troop 4 was a very active troop with lots of camping and activities. During the latter years of my scouting experience, I was in my teens and getting close to earning my Eagle rank. As a teen, however, I was also experimenting with becoming an individual, which involved some rebellious attitudes. During one weekend campout, when we were putting up our tents, I used some pretty rough language to make my buddies laugh. It was the wrong time to do this, as our scoutmaster, Mr. DeKaiser, whom we call DK, was walking by. DK pulled me aside, looked at me and quietly said, "You're too close. Don't mess up." That was all it took. DK's six words were enough. I knew what he meant. He knew I knew. No more was needed. He never brought it up again. From then on, I curbed my tongue, as much as a teenager can anyway, and stayed pretty much on track until I got the Eagle. Now, this wasn't about me being on drugs, being violent, or ditching school. My language wasn't a huge thing as problems go, but at the same time, it's very possible that eventually it could have been, had not DK said those six words to me. He helped me become aware of what I was doing and its possible effects, and he did it right. He was on my side, he was direct and non-condemning, and he let it go to see how I would handle it. I have always been grateful to DK for the little nudge of correction that helped keep me on the right path. That is a great example of what happens when someone sets a boundary and gives some very gentle instruction to a wise person. And I would think we would all want to be wise. It's a great example of how easily one can be corrected when someone sets a boundary and a wise person says, "Oh, I hear that. Let me make that adjustment." And I would hope that would be the cry of our hearts, is, "Lord, let me be that tender-hearted. Let me be that teachable. And Lord, when I have to set a boundary with other people, would you help them be teachable and tender-hearted as well?" But most of the time, we don't have that luxury. So sometimes we have to set boundaries with people, whether or not they're ready to hear us. And so I want to plunge right into some suggestions of how to have those boundary-setting discussions. The first thing that Townsend and Cloud suggest is to be emotionally present. Means you are really engaged and connected to the person when you're having this conversation. It's the first essential of a good conversation, and it really requires a work of grace in us, because often there's conflict. That's why we're having to have a boundary-setting conversation in the first place, and that conflict makes us feel anxious or angry or upset. And it's really easy, it's much easier to handle anxious, angry, and upset if we withdraw physically, emotionally from someone and just kind of put up a defensive wall with them. But to have the most effective boundary setting conversations, we need to stay present and have our hearts be connected. A boundary conversation is very difficult because it feels unnatural. And it is unnatural, in that the natural person within us doesn't think this way. It doesn't think healthy and God-honoring and person-honoring. So some ways to help you be there when you have your boundary conversation is, first of all, be warm, emotionally warm. Remember that although confrontations can be uncomfortable, it doesn't mean you have to be angry or detached or distant from the other person. As much as you're able to, be warm and available to to them. And if you're warm, the other person is much more likely to receive what you have to say. The opposite of being warm is being cold. And you know what that sounds like in a person's voice. Now, there's an edge to the voice and your body language. You know, when you cross your arms in front of your body, you cross your legs, you know, you're basically saying, "I've got a wall between you and me." And when there's a little bit more energy than there really needs to be, you know, which is part of the edge in your voice, honestly, that's one of the best things. If you don't remember anything else I say this morning, just remember to back off and take the edge off your voice. Because if we put an edge to our voice and a little bit of anger and a little bit of more emotional energy than what is really needed, you know, the other person's going to feel defensive. And when you feel defensive, you put up walls and you don't hear what the other person is saying. So in order to keep the walls down, keep your voice relaxed, take the edge off, back up, and ask for help. God is so good about answering that prayer. Help me be warm. Help me take the edge off my voice. Secondly, be in a conversation, not giving a lecture. Does anybody here really enjoy being lectured to by someone who is unhappy with you? Let the other person respond. Don't just download all this information at them. Okay, you sit there and take what I have to give you. Be engaged in a back and forth dialogue, a conversation. Listen to the other person's heart, even if you don't agree with their position. Sandy, could you come up here? I want to illustrate something that was an absolutely life-changing exercise for me one time. Some of you have seen my hero, Dr. Phil, on TV. Before he got his own show, when he was on Oprah, he took cameras into a training room with about 60 different people, and he was teaching them all of these exercises for addressing problems in their lives and in their relationships and stuff, and overcoming bad ways of thinking. And what was very interesting was everything he did on this show, I was familiar with because I had gone through the same thing and some intensive weekend things up in Kansas City. They do the same thing at the Barnabas Project at Fellowship Bible Church Dallas. There was this one exercise that was life-changing in terms of my relationship with my teenage son, and we were just butting heads all the time. What they had us do was get together with one other person, and as if we're arm wrestling, take my hand like this, and pretend there's this invisible table here, and we're going to arm wrestle, okay? And first I say, go ahead, let me do this. First of all, I say, I'm right. Now you push me back.
I'm right.
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 I'm right. Well, this went on and on. It's like, aren't you sick of this? Is it accomplishing anything? Well, duh, no. Okay, now, taught us a new way of dealing with people. You start.
I'm right.
I acknowledge your position. This is my position. Do you see what happened? Let's do that again.
I'm right.
I didn't fight back. I'm letting her push my hand down. And I'm saying, I acknowledge your position. I see what you're saying. I acknowledge you. You know, I hear this is what you're saying. Now, this is my position. And what that is it turns it from this crazy back and forth getting nowhere thing into a dialogue. Thank you, Miss Sandy. You did good. When I came home from that weekend, the entire relationship between Kurt and me was changed forever. Because I'm the mom. Hello, I'm right. All the time, I'm right because I'm the mother. And he had his position of, I'm the teenager. I am distancing myself from you. I am becoming an individual who is not part of you and not part of Dad. I'm my own man, and I insist on doing things my own way. And I kept trying to force him to do things my way, and it wasn't working. And so when I came back and started entering into a dialogue with him rather than a lecture, and he would say things like, I'm not going to school today. The old way would have been, I'm right. Get up. You have to go to school. You have to go. I'm just going to make your life miserable if you don't go. No, 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 no. So he started coming up with, I'm not going to school today. And I'm thinking, I acknowledge your position. First, I had to acknowledge his position. I said, so what you're saying is you prefer to stay home today and you don't care about the consequences because you're choosing to stay home. That's right. Okay. I acknowledge you're 17 years old. I physically cannot make you get up and go to school. And I won't. But I'm also not going to protect you from the consequences of your choices. So if you choose to stay home and not go to school, then you will have to deal with the consequences. My position is it's your responsibility to go to school. That's what you do as a high school student. If you refuse to do that, I will step back, and allow you to deal with the consequences, which would be, you do this enough, and you won't graduate. And he says, so? I don't care. Well, of course, there comes the flesh. What do you mean you don't care? You should care. Education is important. I want to see you walk across that stage. Well, guess what? He kept doing that. And guess what else? He didn't graduate. There were too many absences. His name was in the bulletin for graduating from the class of 1998 from Garland High School, but he didn't walk across the stage, and he never did get a diploma like the other guys. What he ended up doing, he already had his college acceptance. He was thinking, like, I care if I graduate. So he walked in, took his GED, passed it with flying colors, and went, okay, next. And now here we are. He just turned 25 a few weeks ago. And we look back on that time and think, okay, and how important was it that he didn't walk across the stage? Not really all that important, because he has continued to move on, and he's doing fine, and he is achieving what, you know, God has gifted him to do. But he felt respected and honored that I wouldn't push against him at that age. If he was 4, it would be different, but, you know, then you can pick them up and make them go. Not when they're 17. Okay, the third way to help you be there in your boundary conversation is to understand the difference between discomfort and injury. Be willing to suffer discomfort, personal discomfort, up to a point. The point is that line between feeling uncomfortable and actually being injured, where somebody is slapping your soul and being real ugly to you and leaving bruises on your heart. And in that case, you know, you need to not let the person in too deeply. You need to keep some emotional distance from them, or end the conversation until you can have it at a better time when tempers are not flaring and people are not being disrespectful. But if the talk is just about being uncomfortable rather than injurious, keep on pressing through. The goal is reconciliation, even if it's uncomfortable to get there. I have a friend who is dealing with this with her husband, who doesn't know how to relate to her without shaming words. And every time they get into a deep conversation with each other about what is wrong with the relationship, which is basically he is 100% fleshly and wants to be in control, and she is growing as a believer and wants Jesus to be in control, and he resents that. He wants to be the one in control. And so what he does is he resorts to name-calling and insulting and manipulation, and she always feels literally beat up when she finishes these conversations. She has gone from being uncomfortable into being injured. It is absolutely killing her heart toward him. So she can't have these conversations with him because he is not willing to deal with her as an adult level. It's like, I can't talk to you unless you let me hurt you. Well, being a good steward of her heart, she's not willing to do that. Another important concept in setting boundaries is to be clear about the difference between you and me. Boundary setting takes into account that there are two people involved. And there can be problems when you don't clearly distinguish your feelings and opinions as opposed to the other person's feelings and opinions. That process of problem solving and reconciliation can quickly get bogged down if all the lines are blurred and smudged between where you end and I start. You see this when people say things like, you need to change this, rather than, I need for you to change this. There is an I that has a desire and a request for the other person, and there is a you who's being asked to change something. And when people blur those lines of distinction and make it sound like it's all one person that needs to be addressed, it's really hard to set boundaries unless you know this is where I end and this is where you beginning, where you begin. There was an example of it on TV last night. There was a made-for-TV movie about Mork and Mindy, which was the TV sitcom, the comedy, I don't know how long ago it was, with Robin Williams as the alien Mork from Ork. And the movie depicted his descent into out-of-control indulgence, particularly with the use of cocaine and booze and other women. And at one point his wife said, you know, she'd separated from him very wisely, saying, I cannot live like this. You are destroying yourself and I won't live under these circumstances. you need to change. And it was a wake-up call to him. She had every right to say, in order for me to live with you, what she was really saying was, I need for you to change in order for me to continue to live as your wife. And he said, okay, I will do it. And it took the death of John Belushi to finally make him wake up and realize, I need to be very serious about this. But she had every right to say, I will not live under these circumstances where you're never home, you don't talk to me, you're out clubbing every night, there's no connection between the two of us, and you're having affairs with other, you know, you're sleeping with whatever groupie comes up to you. I refuse to live under those circumstances. There needs to be a change. I need for you to change. And she set a boundary between herself and him. It's a great example of a responsible, legitimate boundary to set. If you're not clear about the you and the I in your confrontation, the other person may feel controlled by you. You may assume feelings that they don't have, and they may balk at whatever you want if you don't have these real clear lines of demarcation between them and you. Some suggestions to clarify your communication. You are you and I am I. First of all, look at it. Look at things empathetically. Put yourself in the other person's shoes. Do you like it when other people try to put words in your mouth, which is very manipulative? Do you connect with another person when she tells you what you are feeling, when it's really what she wants you to feel? No. And what happens then is you disconnect from that other person. You just kind of pull the plug on them. So remember that even though boundary setting is hard, so is receiving a boundary setting from somebody else. It's hard when somebody sets a boundary on you. So be gracious when you're the one doing the boundary setting. As Jesus said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. How do you want somebody treating you when they are setting a boundary on you? You want them to be warm and connected and grace-driven and love-filled. That's how we want to receive boundaries. Well, that's how we need to set boundaries for other people. Allow the other person to have the grace to have their own responses to your opinions rather than, I already know what you're thinking. You don't even have to say anything. I already know what you're thinking. I already know what you're going to do. Can you see how inherently disrespectful that is when I purport to be an expert on what you feel and what you will do? That's blurring the lines between you and me. God doesn't do that, and we shouldn't either. Secondly, be clear in your own mind. The more clear you are ahead of time about what you want in the relationship and what you're asking the other person to do, the better things are going to go. It helps to write out ahead of time or talk through with another person who is not involved in the situation exactly what the I part is and the you part is. Many conversations have broken down when the other person says, so what is it that you really want? And you don't know what to say because you haven't thought it through. One of the things Dr. Phil will ask people to fill in the blank, and this was an exercise at this intensive weekend type thing that I did, I mentioned. What I want from you that I'm not getting is, and you fill in the blank. That's a very powerful thing to say to somebody. What I want from you that I'm not getting is, I would like you to look at me when I talk to you. What I want from you that I'm not getting is, I would love for you to bring me flowers on something other than my birthday or Valentine's Day. What I want from you and I'm not getting is help with the dishes or the laundry. What I want from you that I'm not getting is picking up your own dirty socks and underwear. You know, you can fill in that blank with a lot of things. And you're being very clear on what I want and what I want you to do. Very clear distinctions. Third, speak from your need, not the other person's. You can tell the other person, I really need more help from you around the house, or I don't think I can be as close and loving to you as I want to be. What you're saying is, you know, this isn't affecting the way I'm feeling towards you. This is much better than, you need to do more around the house. The other person may not experience that need, and he may likely resent you for telling him what he needs. You need to. In other words, don't even start a sentence with, "You need to." It's much better to say, "I need for you to," or "I want for you to," fill in the blank. That sets the difference between you and me. When people say, "We need to talk," they're confusing their wishes with that of the other person. It's much better to say, "I need to talk to you about something." And guys will tell you, and I've seen it in email joke type things, when a woman starts a sentence with, "We need to talk," it's uh-oh time for him. Because it doesn't mean we need to talk. It means I have a need to dump on you. That's often what's really going on. So "we need to talk" is speaking for the other person. And that's not a wise thing. They're going to feel disrespected. Could that be a matter of small semantic details? Well, yes, but words do matter. In his book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, John Gray says that when a woman asks a man, "Can you take out the garbage?" she is questioning, what he hears is, "You're questioning my ability to do that." What he would prefer to hear is, "Would you please take out the trash?" which is making a respectful request. "Can you take out the trash?" is, he's going to feel like, "What, you think I can't?" Because men are very, very defensive, and anything that's going to question their ability to do things, they're going to probably pull back and put up a defensive line. And I remember reading that and thinking, that is such a small thing, because you know in your head when a woman says to a man, "Can you take out the trash?" what we mean is, "Would you please take out the trash?" We know exactly what we mean. That's not what they hear. They hear the exact literal words we say. That's the way men think, most of them. Now, there's some men that can read, they can receive the coded messages, but they really do take us literally, and so our literal words matter. Another boundary violation that people make is to say, "Oh, you shouldn't feel that way." Don't tell another person how they should be feeling. One of my friends is still dealing with the fallout of hearing just about every day of her life growing up from her mother. She'd say something like, "I am so angry about this," and her mother would say, "Oh, don't feel that way." Or, "No, you don't feel that way. You feel this way." And she was so frustrated by her mother never affirming or allowing for what she was really saying, and assuming that her mother knew better, because after all, I'm your mother. But you know, the Bible says that the only person who can read our minds is God himself. We are not that person. Another thing to never, never say is, "It's stupid to think that way." You know, when you denigrate another person's feelings and thoughts, they're going to feel disrespected. Another aspect of being clear about the "you" and "me" is to be humble. You have no control over the person you're confronting. More than that, you're asking for something that you need from him or her. And it's a humble one-down position, and it helps to accept that. Saying, "I want" and "I need" is a way of letting the other person know that they're important to you, that you do need them, that you're aware that they may see things differently than you do. It's not a comfortable position, but it's the best position to take, because the other person is free to choose whether or not they're going to do what you are asking. And that's the only way to be respectful and loving and kind to someone, is to say, "This is my position," or "This is what I'm asking from you," or "This is what I need from you. I'm offering this information to you, but I acknowledge that it's up to you whether or not you act on it." I got an example of that this weekend when my sister-in-law, who was the mother of Kevin, the young man who was killed in Iraq, she said that when he was in high school, he had already signed up with the Marines, and he was in the delayed entry program through his senior year in high school. And one of the things she was really concerned about was that he would be so gung-ho Marines that he would blow off that whole senior year. And it's still important, because it's character development, even your senior year. There were weekly meetings with all the kids who had enlisted in the Marines at the Marine recruiting facility, and there were certain things that they would do together. But the recruiting officer had assured her that they would never ask the kids to do something with the Marines that would interfere with their other commitments, especially school and family. So one day there was, Kevin had also signed up for the football team, and there was football practice and there was one of these Marine meetings. And he informed his mom, "I'm not going to practice, I'm going to the Marine meeting." And she said, "Oh, okay." And she had been learning about setting boundaries, and she said, "You know, Kevin, it seems to me that the kind of man that the Marines are looking for are the kind of individual who is a man of his word and keeps his commitments. And you did make a commitment to your high school football team. And I'm not telling you you need to go to practice and skip the Marine meeting. I'm not telling you you should. I'm not putting any pressure on you. I am not even going to ask you about it again. I just want to share with you my perspective about what I think the Marines are looking for. And it's a character. You know, the decision you make is a character issue." And so she just left it there. She offered him this information, and she turned around and left it and didn't even ask what was going to happen. And then next thing she sees, he's picking up his practice gear, and he goes, "Okay, I'm going to practice." She said, "Really? You're going to practice?" And he said, "Yeah, I thought about what you said, and I decided you were right. So I'm going to practice." And she was so amazed, because she was learning how to set boundaries in a very respectful way, that she said, "Here's my perspective." You know, she was aware that as a mother, she was still in the training mode, training character into her son. "Here's my perspective. I'm offering it to you, but I'm not putting any pressure on you to do things the way I want you to do them." She was so delighted when he chose of his own free will, because he didn't feel any pressure from her to do what she wanted him to do because of the way she offered it. When we simply provide perspective and make it clear, "I am not telling you to do anything. I'm offering this to you as a choice," it leaves all of the decision making puts the ball in the court of the person who has the right to make that decision. It's a tremendous way of showing humility and respect for them. So as much as possible, stay away from the "we need to" and "you need to" traps. Speak from your own experience, from your own heart, from your own needs. This is going to increase the likelihood that the other person will hear you, because you've clearly identified, "This is me. This is what I'm thinking. This is what I need. This is what I want." Because nobody likes to be told what to think or do. Another aspect of setting boundaries is to clarify the problem. Don't lose focus and end up going over a whole list of offenses that is going to overwhelm the person that you're trying to have this confrontational conversation with. Don't start with something like, "It seems you don't pick up after yourself as regularly as you should," and end up with, "Well, what about the time you forgot the kids at the mall last year?" In other words, don't get historical. Don't dredge up the past and have so many unconfessed issues with the person that you bring in things that have absolutely nothing to do with the subject at hand. That's why the Bible says to keep short accounts and to be sure that you deal with, when you have a problem with someone, don't go to bed angry. You know, deal with the situation. If you can't deal with it, then make an appointment to deal with the situation, and then forgive the other person. When we dredge up the past and we're engaged in a conflict with someone and we start bringing in sins of the past, that is a clear indication that we are still angry and we have not forgiven that person, and that is sin. You know, we start pointing fingers, "And how about this? And how about that? And you keep messing up." When the reality is, we are the ones showing unforgiveness. We are the ones who are sinning as well. So let's look at three important elements of the problem itself and what you would like to see happen when you're dealing with a particular problem. First of all, clarify the nature of the problem. What is this about? Be clear and focused on what the problem is really about. Townsend and Cloud write, "This step may have more than one level to it. For example, a husband might say to his mother, 'Mom, I've noticed that you're pretty critical of Lori's cooking and parenting. You put her down a couple of times in front of everyone at the party last week. I don't know what this is about, Mom, but it seems you are seldom pleased with how she does things.'" Notice the two levels. The specifics, "You put my wife down at this party," and secondly, an observation about the nature of the specifics. "I think there's nothing she can do to please you." It gives the other person clear information about what you're concerned about. It's really unfair to expect the other person to receive our coded messages. You're supposed to read between the lines. You know, I'm just going to dump out of my heart, and I expect you to figure out what my problem is. People are not mind readers. We need to come right out and tell them, this is the problem that I'm having. Secondly, in addition to clarifying the nature of the problem, what is it about, clarify the effects of the problem. What kind of impact is it having on you and your heart and your family and your life? You include not only the facts and realities about the problem, but its impact on your relationship. For example, Townsend and Cloud say, "The husband talking to his mother might say, 'Lori gets discouraged, Mom, because she knocks herself out for you. The kids are confused about why you're so mean to their mom. I'm embarrassed because I feel caught in the middle. And you and I get disconnected because even though I love you, Lori is my wife and she's getting hurt. So it makes things worse for me and for you and for all of us.'" Do you hear what he's saying about these are the effects of your actions? You know, it's hurting my wife. My kids are confused. They're feeling like, why is mommy getting beat up on by grandma? It's causing a disconnect and distance between you and me. Your actions are having this consequence. So often, we will do things and we have no idea of the impact on another person. And we need to know about the impact on another person. Third, clarify your desire for change. Avoid the mistake of stopping with the negative aspects of the problem, because if you do that, you can make the person feel as if they just got dumped on, that there's no way to resolve the problem, to feel that there's no way to please you, or that you are just, what their term is, insatiably critical. If all you do is deal with the negatives, you don't give a way out of the uncomfortableness of the situation. So instead, this is the problem. Now let me give you some suggestions on what I want you to do, what I would suggest that you do to change things, providing the way out of this impasse. It gives the other person hope for the future of the relationship, gives the person structure. It gives them a chance to do something to make the relationship better. This is especially true with men who take things so literally and have most of them, because they're not as sensitive and reading between the lines kind of people as women are, they need to be given a list, A, B, and C. This is what I need from you. If we think, well, if you really loved me, you'd figure out what I want you to do. That does not fly. Now, I'm thinking that just because of the age range of the women in here, everybody pretty much knows that by now, but it's real helpful. Life can point out to you the truth that men are terrible at figuring out what we want them to do without us telling them. If you really loved me, you would know. Those are scary words for a man to hear. So, in this situation, the husband with the mom and the wife, the husband might say, "Mom, here's what I would like you to do. If it's a small matter, drop it. I don't bring up little things to you. If it's a big thing, pull Lori aside and quietly tell her your concerns. She's very open to constructive feedback. And finally, Mom, notice the good things she does and talk about them in front of other people. I would really appreciate it. It would make me feel closer to you, and I think the whole family would benefit." I love that, because so often when we get caught into an endless cycle of being critical and only noticing the things that bug us, it's real hard to notice the good things. And it's real hard to zip our lips and not give vent to those things that really bug us. We need somebody saying, okay, here's a different way of doing what you've been doing. Please be looking for the things she does right. Please talk about them in front of other people. And I loved what they said about if it's a small thing, drop it. Because the scripture says, love covers a multitude of sins. And the scripture also says, it is the glory of a man to overlook an offense. A lot of stuff doesn't need to be dealt with at all. I have a friend that really believed in the early stages of his marriage that in order to have intimacy in their relationship, every little thing that they disagreed about or that he did not particularly like in his wife, he needed to deal with each one because if he didn't, you know, that would be a problem. And so they were constantly tweaking and talking about, you know, and you know what? In the last hour, what you did was this, you know, and it took them several years to discover, you know what, a lot of these problems are because you're a man, I'm a woman, and we're going to do things differently. And I just need you to let it go. That's what God does with us, doesn't he? I mean, if he came down on our case for everything we do, he would be on our case about several times a minute because, you know, we're fallen sinners. And if we're not sinning in what we're doing, we're sinning in what we're thinking. So, you know, God overlooks an incredible amount and he wants us to extend that same grace to others. Another aspect of having boundary-setting conversations with other people is to balance grace and truth. Jesus was the perfect combination of grace and truth. John 1:17 says, for the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. People need both grace and truth in balance to have good relationships with both God and each other. Was there ever a time when someone told you the truth without any love, without any grace? They just massacred you with their words. You need to know this. You probably felt attacked and judged or condemned. No matter how accurate truth is, it hardly matters when the hurtful feelings erase the truth in the confrontation. I can't hear what you're saying because I'm just bloodied and wounded inside. If we massacre each other with the truth, but there's no love and no grace, then the truth is lost on people because I can't get past their hurt feelings. In good boundary conversations, truth needs to be balanced with grace in order for the person to safely receive and digest the information. We need to take the truth and wrap it in grace. On the other hand, have you ever received grace without any truth? Grace comforts us and keeps us safe and loved, but it doesn't provide reality or structure or direction or correction. If somebody is like, oh, it's okay, and what's really happening is you're doing something that is bothering them and is causing a problem in the relationship, but they don't tell you about it because, you know, they just want to be loving and grace-filled, but you can't change or acknowledge what you don't face to begin with. You can't change or heal what you don't acknowledge in the first place. Somebody's got to give you the truth in order for there to be a change. You may have come away from an encounter feeling refreshed and encouraged and have absolutely no insight on what to do next. So we need both grace and truth. What they suggest in the book Boundaries is to lead with grace. Start off with grace because it sets the stage for the other person to be able to tolerate the truth. Tell the person, before we get into this topic, whatever it is that I need to talk to you about, I want you to know I really care about you and I care about us, and I want our relationship to be better, and I want us to be on the same team. I hope I can convey that to you even as we talk about the problem. That kind of communication works just as well in an office situation as it does in a marriage situation or a family situation to say, you know, you are a valuable part of this organization, this team, or whatever, and I care about you, and I care about the us that is part of the team, and I really want you to hear me say that you are so important that we need to deal with an issue to make us even better, to make the team even better, because you're so important. No matter what is about to come, if it is preceded by those kinds of words of affirmation and belief and a sense of desire to connect, their hearts are going to be wide open, or tend to be more open to what is going to come next. It's important not to assume that the other person already knows these things. In fact, when you're having a boundary conversation, it's more important for the other person to be reassured of the grace that is accompanying the truth. What they suggest is, when in doubt, go for grace. Because the damage done by a lack of grace is far greater than the damage done by a lack of truth, which is absolutely, that is so true. With grace alone, you stand a chance of having another conversation. If you use truth alone with no grace, you may shut down things that will never open again, and the person will never again listen to you. Things can fall apart. Another way to have boundary conversations, the importance is to stay on task. I have a feeling this one is probably going to really resonate with you. Reading from chapter 7 of Boundaries Face to Face, what Townsend and Cloud write is, here is a common crazy-making script in confrontations. I love that term, crazy-making, because, you know, it's when people do things that just drive you nuts. You, Sharon, I'd like to talk about a problem in our relationship. Sharon, well, what about all the things you do? You, like what? Sharon, you never call when you're going to be late, you work too much on the weekends, you don't spend enough time with the kids, you don't help around the house. This little script illustrates a common problem in having the talk, the inability to stay on track and on task. A good confrontation has a specific and clear focus. It can be reduced to one or both of two things. Number one, you want the other person to start doing something you want, or number two, to stop doing something you don't want. If all goes well, each of you understands the other's view and feelings, and then you agree on how things will change. This is how the conversation above could be kept on track. Starts out the same way. You, Sharon, I'd like to talk about a problem in our relationship. Sharon says, well, what about all the things you do? You, I know I do things that irritate you, but I want to focus on my concern right now. Sharon, sure, it's always about you. You, I'll be glad to talk later about what you want to talk about, but for now, I'd like to talk about how we can stay within our budget. Did you see what they did? You know, the other person was, you know, you want to talk to me about me? Well, I'm not going there. I'm not taking that bait. We're going to be talking about you and your shortcomings. And what the person says is, we can have that conversation, and I do want to hear from you, but right now we're talking about this subject, and you bring it back on task. When the other person says, we're going to go down this rabbit trail, you go, mm-mm. No, I'm not going to go down that rabbit trail with you. That's another conversation. We can have it at another time. And I promise I will have it at another time. But right now, I need to talk about the issue of being late to church every day, every Sunday. You keep bringing it back to the topic at hand. And the only way you can do that is if you realize what's happening. This person's going down a rabbit trail, and it's your responsibility to say, okay, later, we'll bookmark that thought, we'll come back to it later, we're going to come back to it, we're going to come back to what I need to talk about here. It's really no different than leading a Bible study when people go off on rabbit trails. Has anyone ever noticed that in Bible studies, you know, where someone gets an idea and you're down this happy rabbit trail, and suddenly a half an hour later, you know, because no one has said, okay, that is an interesting thought, but we need to finish this concept right here, and they bring it back to the subject at hand. There's really no difference. You can give yourself permission to do that when you have a confrontational conversation with someone. Say, no, I'm not going to let you hijack this conversation and take it where you want to go so that the emphasis is on me instead of you. In the book, You Can Work It Out, which is about accepting responsibility for your own stuff in relationships. The author Chuck Lynch says that often when he starts laying out areas of personal responsibility when he's as a counselor, someone says, "I feel like you're picking on me." And he said this is often the first time that the person has been forced to face the x-ray of their relationship, and it's ugly. You know, as a counselor, he'll say, "Okay, this is what I'm seeing as what's happening in the relationship. You know, you are doing da 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 da, and this other person's doing da 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 da." And one of the people says, "Oh, you're picking on me," which is deflecting the guilt and the blame to the person who's doing the picking. And he, as a counselor, sees that as, you know what, you're just being defensive because you don't like what I'm showing you. I'm picking up a mirror and showing you what's there, and you're not liking it. And it's my job is to force you to deal with reality and not, you know, be distracted. Very often, when people have long-standing patterns of negative behavior and attitudes, they also have long-standing patterns of really bad character problems. And these bad character patterns keep they maintain these problems going with the negativity and the criticalness, both what they think and what they do. And they're going to have an internal resistance to seeing themselves as wrong or flawed or responsible. "I don't like what you're showing me, so I'm going to bring up the defensive force fields and deflect it." So when people are showing them how reality is and giving them feedback and supporting their argument with examples and circumstances, this person turns a blind eye to their immaturity and hurtfulness. And what their response is, you know, this problem, there is no problem. It doesn't exist. Or this problem is not as bad as you think. You are blowing this way out of proportion. You are making a mountain out of a molehill. Or they'll say, you know, "I do not have a problem. It's your fault." And it's all ways of saying, nope, not going to receive responsibility for this. No, I am not. The other person wants to deflect and divert the attention anywhere away from what they're doing. Then you find yourself sidetracked and lost. And when you bring up something and somebody diverts the attention someplace else, you know what's happening is they're being defensive. And it's really helpful to tell yourself, "I recognize that. That's a defensive maneuver. And I need to counteract it and not let them get away with it." It's about holding their feet to the fire. So, ways to deal with another person's defensiveness. First of all, be prepared for it. Don't be surprised or upset. Accept this as part of that person for now until they decide to change. And so when the person gets defensive, you go, "Yep, there they go. I was waiting for the defensive move, and there it was." If you put a label on somebody's behavior, it makes it easier to handle. It's like, I'm not buying that. You know, this person is being defensive. I'm going to label it as defensive, and then I'm going to go on. Secondly, hear them out to a point. Townsend and Cloud write, "It's always best to give the person a chance to be heard and understood. You cannot go wrong with that position, as you're giving grace before moving in with truth. You might say, 'I didn't realize that you felt so nagged by me. I really do want to look at that, and if I'm doing that, I want to change it.'" So what you're saying is, "I hear what you're saying." If a person deflects and says, "Let's talk, you know, you're always nagging me," you receive it. "I didn't realize that it was bothering you so much. I want to look at that. I want to change it." But you're going to bring things back to the subject. And they say, "Note, however, that we said to a point." When a person is open to feedback, she needs her point to be heard, and then she is ready to hear yours. When you are dealing with a character problem, it's different. After you've heard her out, she may still not be open to hearing you. She always has another excuse, or she blames you again. It's not good for either of you for this to go on indefinitely. So the third thing is, you make several attempts to get things back on track. Again, you're giving grace. You simply listen, you empathize, and you bring the topic back to the issue at hand. Say things like, I really will take a look at my part there. I don't want to make the problem worse, but I want to get back to what I was saying about your drinking. I want to get back to what I was saying about whatever the topic is. Don't give up quickly on this. Many people try to stay on topic, but then they feel it's hopeless and they just shut down. The message that they're sending to the other person is that a little resistance will end things. Be persistent. Let the other person know, I'm not giving up on this. I'm going to keep bringing it up because it's important to our relationship. Our relationship is more important than your discomfort and my discomfort at dealing with this. And then fourth, you can make the very defensiveness an issue. If the person has a pattern of diverting things, bring that into the light and don't get sidetracked by excuses. You can say things like, you know what? I notice that every time I talk about our problem of how to allocate the chores around the house, it seems you get angry or you change the subject. I really do want to own my part, and I will be glad to when we deal with your part. But that's hard for me because you keep diverting things. Can you tell me what's going on when I bring up problems or how I can give you feedback in a better way? Which is a very gracious way of saying, you are being defensive, which doesn't come off really well. You know, you've got to kind of coat that with words of grace. Now, I notice that when I bring up this, you keep trying to go off on a rabbit trail. Can we talk about why you do that? You know, what's going on inside of you that makes it so impossible for you to look at what we're talking about here? And you're dealing with the very defensiveness, which most people are blind to. They're just kind of swimming in a sea of defensiveness, and they're not aware of it. It's kind of like asking a fish, what is it like to be wet? Fish don't know what wet is. That's the way they live. A fish can't know what wet is until you take him out of the water and he experiences what dry is, you know? A lot of people just live in defensiveness because I've got to protect myself all the time. So you need to shine a light into a dark place. And you're not blaming. You inquire. The person may be feeling judged or put down, and simply by reassuring them that you're on his side may be enough to get him back on track. A number of years ago, I had a very interesting conversation. It was a relationship-changing information with my husband, who, being a typical man, and I could say this with him standing right here next to me, and he would not be offended in the least bit. Being a typical man, he is very defensive about any time bring up that he has made a mistake, or you intimate that he is about to make a mistake. Most men's egos are extraordinarily fragile. As a matter of fact, when you think about men's egos, think soap bubble, not brick, okay? We're talking really, really fragile. And so I asked him one day, how would you like me? This was not in the midst of a conversation. We weren't in the midst of a difficulty at all. I said, I have a question for you. I want you to help me understand something. How would you like me to point things out to you that you need to know so that you don't feel defensive? For example, if I think you are on you're on autopilot when we're driving, and you're going to miss the exit because you're on autopilot, how do you want me to say things to you so that you don't react defensively? And he gave that some thought, and then we talked through what can I say? And actually, the very act of having that conversation brought the defensiveness out into the light, and he took responsibility for it and said, you know, when I would say things like, our exit's coming up, which is simply imparting information. There's no value associated to it. You know, you're going to miss the exit again. You see the difference. You know, just the exit's coming up. Or I would ask a question like, are you going to take a different route home than we usually do? You know, which is kind of indirect, and sometimes you really need to be indirect in order to take care of the ego problem. You know, when he would feel defensive, he'd flash back to this conversation that we'd had and go, you know what, that's just my defensiveness. I don't need to be defensive. She loves me. She only wants what's in my best interest. And he would make a conscious decision to say, you know, that defensiveness is flesh, and I'm going to let it go, which is one of the reasons I love my husband so much. But asking him, how do you want me to point things out to you, was a great, great conversation that we had, and it lowered the conflict when I saw things that he didn't. So I'm so glad we did that. But you know what? You may be the one who reacts defensively. It may be you that can't stand for anybody to point out to you when anything is wrong, or point out sin, or point out a shortcoming or a character defect. You may be the one that I can't believe they would say such a thing. If it's you who's got this defensive flesh, understand, defensiveness is nothing but pride. That's all it is. It's protecting our egos, and there is nothing in our flesh that brings glory to God. There's nothing in our flesh that is worth hanging on to. There's nothing in defensiveness that is good. It's all about pride. Recognize it as sin and let it go, and invite God into that part of you that wants to react defensively. It is not part of your it is not part of your new nature. You know, sanctification means recognizing stuff like that and repenting of it and letting it go. And then the final principle in dealing with having these conversations is use the formula, when you do A, I feel B. It's the law of consequences coming up again. When this happens, here's the effect. One of the most powerful and effective ingredients of a good boundary conversation is explaining to a person how their attitudes and actions affect you. When you do A, I feel B. In other words, you show what another person does affects your emotions. When you do that, you're opening your heart to the other person, and that can often get through to them because it connects to the love and the care that they have for you. It helps them move away from the desire to win an argument and into being involved with the relationship and working on the relationship. This ingredient is also very important because it avoids blame and assault. When you tell somebody how you feel, it's describing an internal reality in your own heart that the other person might not be aware of. And we need to remember, no one can read our minds. Other people don't know what we're thinking and feeling. We have to tell them. It's the opposite. Opening your heart and saying, this is how I feel, is the opposite of the blame barrage where someone runs through a list of all the other person's infractions. Because if somebody starts dumping on you, you do this and this and this and this, not many people can remain open and defensive when we're hit with that. They become more invested in protecting themselves from all the badness and the guilt and the condemnation that's being thrown at them. So here's a few things to keep in mind as you bring your feelings into the boundary conversation. First of all, concentrate on your feelings, not your thoughts. It's hard. It's easy to use the word feel and then describe a thought. For example, when you negate my words, I feel like I shouldn't say anything. I shouldn't say anything is not a feeling. That's a thought. It's a mental process. And it would be better to say, when you negate my words, I feel hurt and disconnected from you. You see the difference? Hurt and disconnected are feelings. I feel like I don't matter to you, or I feel like I shouldn't say anything. Those are thoughts. It's not the same thing, and we easily misuse those. Secondly, identify your feelings. Now, this may take some work. A lot of people don't know what they're feeling inside. There was a time when we had Kurt was seeing a counselor, and he had a little card sitting on his table in his office that had a list of feelings on it that he would have to point to sometimes and say, which of these are you feeling? And I believe what was on the list was hurt, sad, angry, frustrated, afraid, and anxious. Those are six different feelings. And it's helpful to know, okay, I'm feeling something, but what is it I'm feeling? One mistake a lot of people make is to identify angry feelings as hurt feelings. Everything is anger. You know, it's a safe place to be. I can hide behind my anger. You know, I'm feeling hurt, but I translate it as I'm mad. It's helpful to know what it is you're feeling, and so to put the right label on it. You may need to ask some friends to help you understand when you're hurt and when you're angry, you know, and talk through what is it that you are feeling. There's a great sense of power that comes from knowing what it is you're feeling. Putting a label on something makes you in charge rather than having the feelings be in charge, because they can rise up and control you, and you're just feeling like you're overwhelmed by this wave of feeling, but you don't know what it is. But if you can label it, if you can name it, you have control over it to some degree. Third, stick to your experience, not what you think that the other person's doing. Instead of saying things like, when you negate my words, I feel like you don't care about me. Not a good plan. Say, when you negate my words, I feel alone and unloved. And what you're doing is you're giving I messages rather than you messages. When you negate my words, you are showing that you don't respect me. And you're giving you messages. And when you're giving you messages, you're pointing your finger at somebody, and that's a very offensive thing to do. Which is, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen pastors when they're preaching and they're pointing fingers at people in the congregation. You just want to go, stop that. It's very offensive when people point fingers, and we can do it verbally too, by giving you messages. The best way to have a conversation with anybody is to keep to I messages, because I don't know what you're thinking and feeling. You are the expert on you. I'm the only expert on me. So stick with I messages. Fourth, avoid the statement, you make me feel, fill in the blank. Although it's true that the other person highly influences you emotionally, convey to this person your reaction to her rather than about her power and control over you. If you avoid this kind of blaming statement, it keeps the other person from reacting to being blamed. For example, if you say, you make me feel so frustrated. And the other person could well come back and say, I make you feel frustrated? How can I do that? I don't control your feelings. You control your feelings. I don't have the power to make you feel frustrated. That's something that's going on inside of you. Making an association for the other person solves a lot of problems. Instead of saying, you frustrate me, what you do is, when you do A, I feel B. When you are constantly late, I feel frustrated and important. Instead of, you do this to me, you make me feel such and such. Instead, when you do A, I feel B. And what you're giving them is the I message. I'm feeling this. And fifth, you can own your part of the feelings. You're not ascribing fault as much as opening a window into your heart so the other person has access into your internal world. You can say things like, I know I get hurt too easily, and that's not you, that's me. But last night when you made fun of my dress at the party, I really felt attacked and embarrassed. You can say, you know, I may have a very sensitive, hypersensitive, you know, skin here, but I do want you to know that when you did A, I felt B. And sixth, be specific, specific, specific. Give the other person a description of what they really said or did, or the tone of voice that they used, so that they have a picture of the situation. When you teased me about my weight at the table the other night, I felt hurt inside. When you did A, I felt B. That's very specific. You teased me about my weight, as opposed to, you were really insensitive to me. What is that supposed to mean? How is the other person supposed to know what you're talking about? You need to identify the specific thing that you did. This is the effect that it had. Saying, when you do A, I feel B, is at heart not only a way of confronting, but also a way of reaching out to the other person. You're allowing the other person to see into your heart. And that's our words are the only way we have of unzipping our hearts and letting somebody see what's going on. And that's the way we connect with another person's heart, is through our words. That's a very powerful tool in your life skills toolbox to use. Just in closing, let me tell you that someone has used the analogy that I absolutely love, that all parents give their child a toolbox for doing life, particularly doing relationships. It's what we, the family we grow up in, you know, what we are shown and what we are taught by example, there is a toolbox. And your toolbox may be totally empty, or it may only have a hammer in it. The only thing you know to do is to go around banging on people. And if parents don't have a lot in their toolbox, you cannot give someone else what you don't possess in the first place. What we're doing here in going through these weeks on boundaries is I am offering you a Home Depot of relational tools, where if you don't have these in your toolbox, you can always go down the street and get more. And that's one of the benefits of going through the subject of boundaries, which is all about getting new relational tools for dealing with other people. You can have something other than a hammer or something other than a screwdriver in your toolbox. You've got new ways of dealing with people. A tool like, if you do A, I feel B, that's a tool. It's a way of helping work the relationships that we have and tweaking them to get to the best possible level that we can get there. It occurred to me that you may have thought, why are we talking about boundaries when this is Bible study? Well, it's appropriate to talk about these things because boundary setting is a biblical concept. Jesus did it. Many of the pastoral epistles talk about how to relate. The one anothering commands in Scripture are all relational issues. And the way that you learn how to relate to each other is by setting boundaries and knowing what is true. And so what we're doing with going through the study on boundaries is taking a look at the basic biblical concepts about boundary setting and then drilling down into what does that mean in real life? How do we live out these biblical concepts of valuing one another above ourselves, of being forbearing, of treating each other as more important than we are? Those are all the biblical values. What does that look like in real life? How do we go from the concept to the nuts and bolts of making it work for us? Which is why I just really want to thank you again for how open you've been to what I have to share, because my understanding of boundaries has really deepened my understanding of the scriptural admonitions of how we are to relate to each other. It has deepened my appreciation of the fullness and the veracity of God's word. So let me close this in prayer. Father, I thank you so much for this time we've had together. Thank you for the wisdom that you've given your servants, Drs. Townsend and Cloud. Thank you for how interested you are in us learning how to love each other wisely and well in a way that is glorifying to you, and that boundaries play a huge role in that. Lord, I am confident that you will continue to provide opportunities to put into practice these things that we've been learning today and over the previous weeks. Because you do like to test us on new material, don't you? And so, Lord, when those tests come, I pray for my sisters that they would allow you, the Holy Spirit, to bring to remembrance the things that you want us to remember, to use these tools to your glory, and to build relationships that you've given us to be a steward of. In Jesus' name, amen.